Testing 1, 2. Test. 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 Okay. I'm great. Yep, all set. Thank you. For you. Can you bring up a live website during my presentation?
Yeah.
There's a website I'd like you to show.
Okay.
It's classicalu.ning.com.
Are you recording this
part?
Yeah. Or should I put my iPhone up there?
Yeah, I'll put it up there.
www.classicalu with just the letter U.
Classicalu.
Classicalu. Dot Ning.
Dot what?
N-I-N-G. Ning. Dot com. Thank you.
Yeah, no,
towards the end of the presentation, when I'm doing applications, I'll ask you to bring it up. I might ask you to click on one or two things. In fact, while I'm making the presentation, you could click on, just to kind of show people how it functions. Feel free to move it around, but I'll probably give you some directions. Excuse me.
Virginia until Wednesday, but when I get back from that, I can give you all the money. You have coffee there. Oh, someone brought you a Starbucks.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I put you in a coffee bag.
Oh.
You can have it, but I've been drinking for it.
It doesn't matter.
I got water for you.
Great, thank you. Beautiful.
I'm going to be using my iPhone to record the talk. So,
okay.
My name's Andrew, by the way.
Hi, I'm
nice
Chris.
To meet you, Chris.
Pleasure.
One of the teachers here.
I'm also recording it via
good.
MP3, so if something goes wrong.
Excellent. Good. Then we have double redundancy here.
That's right. Redundant systems. What do you teach, Andrew? What do you teach here?
I teach, next year I've been doing all kinds of stuff. Next year I'm doing 7th grade writing, 8th grade lit, 9th grade pre-rhetoric, 9th grade Bible and history, and speech and debate. So,
excellent.
Yeah.
There's a...
Good, how are you, Mrs.?
Hello.
Hello.
Did
Did you get that email
from
Yes.
Okay. Yes.
Say, Andrew, email me, and I'd like to send you a manuscript of a book on on debate and discussion.
Oh, that would be great.
That you could use and review. It's in first draft form, but we're looking for some teachers to use it.
Like
tell us
curriculum kind of thing?
Yeah, it's kind of like a complimentary curriculum for speech and debate.
Well, good morning, everyone.
I'll email it to you.
Welcome to Trinity Classical Academy's summer conference, and we get to spend a couple of days together pursuing excellence, but hopefully just enjoying the time to sit and learn and have conversations. I know many of us from the various schools that we're from feel that we're usually moving very quickly down the hallway and having two-second conversations and on to the next thing. Let me introduce myself. My name is Liz Caddo for our schools that are visiting, and my husband and I founded Trinity, and I'm acting as the head of school for Trinity, and it is a pleasure to have you with us, and we consider it a privilege to just have other schools joining our faculty and staff and our families here today as we pursue classical Christian education together and how we can learn from one another and continue to grow in our journey as schools so that we can continue to bless the children that the Lord brings us and helping them learn well and think well, write well, and read well, all the things that we desire to do with our students. Mr. Horner, our Rhetoric School Humanities Chair, is going to pray for us. But before we do that, I just wanted to take a few minutes to welcome our schools that are joining us from actually pretty far. This is our first year. We kind of got to laughing as a team. We've been doing our conference for several years now. Our school just finished its 10th year in our valley. We started with 26 students, and this year have had 337 students. And next year we have our first senior class, and we're very excited about that. We've been adding a grade every year. But we've been doing our conference for years, and this is the first year that we feel like more people are coming, that people are actually coming besides ourselves. So we are thrilled to have you. And we have from Grace Christian Academy in Carson City, Nevada. Do you mind standing and letting us know where you are? Great, it's good to have you. Thank you for coming. Can someone share how big your school is and how old you are? Not you personally, just your school. No, you can share. I'm just saying, you don't have to tell us how old you are. Yes.
We're about 60 kids.
Great. Terrific. Well, welcome. And we hope, too, for our schools that are coming and they might be a little bit younger than we are at Trinity, that this could be a place of encouragement for you the next couple of days as you get a chance to talk with teachers that are maybe teaching what you're teaching at the same grade level from another school, or administrators. Whatever we can do for you in these next couple of days to encourage and help you see what the next step is. And we have benefited from schools that have gone before us, and we hope to be able to do that for you here. Let's see, we have Grace Classical Academy from Laguna Niguel. Where's your contingent sitting? Maybe they're still driving. Yes, that is a bit of a drive in the morning, so we will greet them when they come. Heritage Oaks from Tehachapi. Great. Why don't you stand up? Someone speak for your school. We'll be happy. Terrific. It's good to have you. Is Rich Engel still at your school? Just couldn't make it today. Tell him we said hello. Maranatha from Pasadena. Good to have you.
We're actually a non-classical high school. We're just checking things out to see what you guys are doing. So we're about 650 kids in high school. So I've been around since 1965.
Excellent, good. Very good. Good to have you. They're going to drink a little bit of the Kool-Aid today. Very good. We have Oaks Christian from Westlake. Good to have you. Start our time with prayer, and this morning we are blessed to have Dr. Chris Perrin begin our time. He is from the Institute for Classical Schools, and he will start us off this morning. Grant.
Thanks. So you guys have been flirting with classical schools? You know what they say about flirting? It means either bad behavior or marriage. Let's pray. Madras Haskone, Vladimir Swalde. Father, St. Augustine's words, you are great and greatly to be praised, are in our hearts and on our lips this morning. We see your great work in creation. We see your great work in Scripture. We see your great work in Christ. And we praise you greatly. We see your great work in humans. We see your great work in children who need instruction, correction, guidance, mentoring, and discipleship. We see your great work in this school here at Trinity. We see your great work in a number of other schools represented here. We thank you for your great work. We praise you and exalt you for your great work, all of which points back to you and to the majesty of your glory. So we just invite the sweetness of the presence of your Spirit here this morning, today, and tomorrow. We ask you to guide our thoughts and words and actions. We ask you to be with each of the speakers and presenters and with those who hear what they have to share out of their knowledge and wisdom. We ask you to be blessed in your heart, to bless our hearts with words of wisdom, encouragement, and exhortation. Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit, we praise your holy name.
Amen. Good morning.
Good morning.
You know, just by the fact that Liz had everyone stand up and introduce themselves, and the fact that everyone was welcomed the way that you have been is already a testament to what I want to share with you as we get going this morning, and that is the primacy and the importance of community. Community is almost a cliche. We talk about community in various contexts. Community easily rolls off our lips, and any group of people who are together and most loosely affiliated can be called a community. You can be a community of left-handed third basemen. You know, anything can be a community. But really, community needs to be recovered as a profoundly important concept. Indeed, maybe the most important thing that we do as believers when we are gathered together. Koinonia, communio. We need to recover these words and their meaning. In our society where we have this facile community, where things are so artificial and superficial and ephemeral, we need to recover true commitment to one another, true friendship. The ancients talked about the great importance of friendship. Aristotle, Plato, those guys, Cicero wrote a treatise on friendship. They thought that one of the highest things was to be able to get together with people you really loved and talk about the things that were most important to you, usually with something to drink. We get the word symposium from a group of people who come together with drinks. Symposia, with drinks. Well, we have Starbucks coffee. Actually, Andrew has some Starbucks coffee. He left it here on the stage, and I grabbed it, and he said, no, that's mine. But my colleague Grant has brought me a cup of coffee, and I have water, and I have friends. What could be better than to be together with your friends? In fact, if you think about the highest things in your life, if you could do anything this weekend, what would you like to do? What if I said, I have $2,000 for you, and you can take this and do whatever you would like to do, but you can't go spend it on merchandise? Wouldn't you want to be with the people that you care about most, probably enjoying a great meal, in a great setting, having conversation? You think about it, think about your lives growing up in the church. How many of you've probably sat under some talented, gifted pastors? Can you even name five sermons and the impact they've had upon you? Can you name two? But if I were to ask you to name three or four friends, they would roll off, their names would roll off your lips, wouldn't they? Studies show that students will forget about 75% of the content we teach them, even with songs, chants, and jingles. For those of you visiting from non-classical schools, that's a classical pedagogy that we talk about. You probably already know that. You wouldn't be here if you already didn't already know something about what classical is. And by the way, I'm going to argue that you're already classical. We're already in the tradition. We're already somewhat classical. It's a continuum. It's not a bifurcation fallacy like Mr. Horner was suggesting, whether you're either flirting or marriage. As persuasive as that fallacy may be to you, we're all on a journey. We're all on a continuum here. We have inherited a tradition. We're living within an inheritance and a tradition, whether we know it or not. You're born into the United States. You are born into a tradition, which means something has been handed down to you from your elders, your ancestors. And you're living it, and they're impacting you. The founders of the U.S. Constitution are impacting you as you sit here today as American citizens. You're in a tradition. But what's sad is that many of us don't even know in any significant way what that tradition is with integrity, because Americans don't like to study history anymore. We flit from website to website, but we are not capable of sustained study the way we used to be. We are no longer the informed citizenry that Jefferson said we need to be. Because we can Google anything. The internet is making us stupid in one degree. Nicholas Carr wrote a book about this called The Shallows, preceded by an article that was published in the Atlantic Monthly called How Google's Making Us Stupid. He calls his book The Shallows because he says, in terms of the way we acquire knowledge, we're like jet skiers skimming across the surface of a lake. We can go far, but we stay on the surface. We can no longer deep dive. And if we're to recover something valuable, men and women, we have to deep dive. We have to study what has come to us. We have to pay attention to the inheritance. Part of that inheritance is communitas. It's community. And community is classical. I was the founding head of a school in Pennsylvania, in Harrisburg, 1997. I won't go into this story at the moment, but if you want to hear the story, Liz and Wally have a story. We all have a story. How did we get into this thing? Grant has a story, and his is the best that I've heard, or one of the best that I've heard. You just have to hear him going from drug culture to Latinist and Renaissance literature specialist and so forth. How did that happen? Well, there is a narrative aspect to everything that's happening in this renewal. We also need to listen to the story, listen to the narrative that's come down to us, and find ourselves living within it. And it is classical. I remember being surprised as a new head of school, maybe 5 years into my job as head of school at Covenant Christian. I'm proudly wearing the polo shirt from Covenant Christian Academy. And coming to the realization as a new head of school, relatively new head of school, that community was classical. And that it was primordially classical. It goes all the way back to the Old Testament assembly of the Israelites being called out of Egypt. Out of Egypt I have called my son, Israel. And Jesus, of course, becomes that new Israel. And that very prophecy is quoted in Matthew, referring to Jesus coming back out of Egypt. But the Israelites were the called out ones. And the Greek word there is ekklesia. And it's taken right into the Latin. We get the word ecclesiastical from it. It means to be called out. Ekklesia. To be called out. Ek means out. And Jesus came and he called people to follow him. He called a new Israel together, called the ecclesia, the church. And to be a Christian means to have heard Christ's call, to have a vocatio, and to be following after this Christ who becomes the new ideal man. The Greeks had been searching for the embodied excellence in a man, erete, and sought to cultivate this idea of human excellence. You see it in their sculpture. You see them trying to physically embody the most excellent man. And they tried to do this morally as well and civically. And their whole training process called paideia, the raising up of a child from infancy to a fully functioning adult Greek citizen who could vote in the assembly and could serve in the military, that's paideia. They were searching, they were trying to pattern themselves after an ideal man. They believed there was a kind of transcendental excellency, Plato, Platonic forms and so forth, that they could strive to realize, but they never could. They could never transcend their own pride and selfishness and imminence. And then Christ came. Some of the Greek philosophers talked about this divine spark of reason that was in every man, the logos spermatikos, and that part of what made you a human was that you had this divine spark of reason within you, this logos. Christ came, and John writes in his gospel, in arche ein ho logos, in the beginning was the Logos. And when the Greek readers read that word, they would have known that John was addressing all of Greek philosophy preceding that point and saying, the ideal that you were looking for, the fulfillment of Greek philosophy, has come to us and dwelt among us because the Logos became flesh, lived among us. So the ideal man now has a face, has broken into history. And he calls others to follow after him. First the other disciples, and then through the disciples, all of us. Do you realize that you have a chain to one of the 12 disciples? Those 12 disciples went and talked to others and called others who called others who called others, and eventually you were called. It might have been your own mother or grandmother or father. But there's a chain to one of those 12 disciples. Who are you? Are you Peter's? Are you Matthew's? Who do you belong to? I like to think that I'm in the chain of John. It's my favorite gospel. But we're all in the chain of Christ. And we are to be Christ ones. And we are called out to be a community. This is the fundamental thing that applies as time goes by. Whether you name yourself as a classical, liberal arts, standard Christian school, doesn't whatever adjectives you want to use. If we aren't in community, we might as well just close the doors. It's classical because it comes to us from the biblical times, right up through the Greeks and Romans, from Old Testament, Greeks and Romans, to the coming of Christ, to then the founding of the church. And the early church took community very seriously. You see this in Acts chapter 2, where they shared everything in common. And that, of course, is the root of the word community, is to have something shared in common, a shared cultural, historical inheritance or heritage. So the early church began to gather in a community, and it was one of the ways in which it grew, as people saw them loving each other. It wasn't so much that they were propounding Latin paradigms and teaching the logical fallacies and having classes on rhetoric that caused the church to grow. It was their community that pulled people in. The lower classes primarily at first, loving one another. When they were being persecuted and suffering, loving one another, such that they became an undeniable attraction. And many came in to the church. Eventually, through the lower classes, slaves, to households, to women, finally to the aristocracy, until finally Constantine's household, and then Constantine himself around 300 AD becomes a Christian, and then things change in a dynamic way, politically and otherwise. And Christendom begins to be formed in the Middle Ages. And we live in that inheritance. We live in the inheritance of Christendom. It may be fragmented, it may be waning, it may be splintered in various ways, it certainly is, but it's still there, and it's still having its say, and it's still very powerful. And guess what? It's always renewable, it's evergreen, it's like the trick candle that you can't blow out. Just when you think that the church is dead, it starts to rise again. And there have been these reformations throughout history, these renaissances, these new syntheses of things too, where the church has constantly been looking at what's been going on in culture, appropriating things that have been good in humanity and nature, filtering out that which is rebellious and not so good, and doing something new. So now we are singing a new song. We continue to sing a new song until the new Jerusalem will come down from heaven. We are always reforming, semper reformanda. We are always looking to be new. Classical education is just part of this. And guess what? It's shape-shifting. It's a shape-shifting enterprise. If you think of classical education, this tradition of liberal arts, as kind of like a statue that you've dug up out of the ground, and there it is, and now we just need to kind of chisel all of our students after it, you're wrong. Because it's not a thing. It's an idea. And it's not just an idea. It's a bundle. It's a collection of ideas. And ideas, if they're good and they're human, never, ever grow old. If we are made to be reasonable creatures, if we have this thing called reason, this thing called logos within us, then learning how to reason correctly, learning the principles of correct reasoning and incorrect reasoning, we could call that logic. Is that going to be pertinent today as it was in 300 AD? If human nature continues to be the same, then the discipline or the art of logic is evergreen and ever relevant. Does it not follow? So classical education is a collection, a bundle of great ideas that have been tested and tried by your ancestors, by your elders, many people, many bright men and women for centuries have thought about these things. That's the inheritance, and how can we ignore it? Chesterton, favorite of mine, says that tradition is the democracy of the dead. Tradition is the democracy of the dead. He says that the simple inconvenient fact that a person happens to be dead ought not to invalidate their vote, ought not to prevent them from having a say. In this tradition, call it classical education, call it the liberal arts tradition, call it other things, traditional education, we have paid attention to the primary sources. We've wanted to go ad fontes, back to Plato and Aristotle. Why read all the thousands, countless commentaries on Plato and Aristotle? Why are there countless commentaries on Plato and Aristotle? Because you can read him and understand him, and he's profound. Or both of them. It was said of Plato and Aristotle that never had a teacher such a student or a student such a teacher. Read Plato and Aristotle yourselves, and you'll find that they are accessible. You can go right to the fountain and drink from it. Yet in America, we want to elevate the criticism to the same level as the source texts. You can give 8th graders and 9th graders the dialogues of Plato, and they will respond remarkably well. So we go ad fontes, but we're paying attention to a tradition. The word trato tradere in Latin means to hand over. It means to impart. It means to commit. It means to entrust. Something has been entrusted to you. But many Americans don't even know what it is. We know the contours. We have a sense of it. And by the way, you educators, some of you are new to classical education, the liberal arts education, we're going to talk about this in our time together, but folks will come in thinking, well, what is it? Tell me what it is. I want to know if I can do it, and please give me the map and the definitions and the description so that I can be sure that I'm doing what Liz Caddow wants me to do. I want to teach classically in my classrooms. I want to be a classical teacher. What is it? You're already classical to a degree. It's not a matter of either or. It's a matter of degree. How coherent are you? How embodied is your classical approach? How full, how integrated, how deep is your understanding? But if you have taught or been taught the ABCs using the song, the tune of Twinkle Twinkle Little Star, A, B, C, D, E, F, G. I didn't realize till I was ahead of school that was a Twinkle Twinkle Little Star melody. But that's a class. You're being classical. You're using a song to teach little children how to memorize important material. That's a tradition that comes down from the ancients. See, what happened is the Greeks and the Romans, as human beings, fallen of course, began to explore and experiment on how to teach people to use their tongues, for one. How to understand arguments, how to make arguments, how to understand language and interpret language, grammar. Arguments and so forth on how they work, syntax, logic, how to be persuasive, how to be pleasing to the ear, how to say things in such a way that would be captivating and memorable, how to move people to action and new beliefs, rhetoric, the art of persuasion. They worked on this just like other human beings were working on how to cultivate the soil. The Greeks worked on how to cultivate the human tongue. We call those three arts, the trivium, the threefold way of mastering language, mastering your lingua. The church looked at that. When paganism and this Greek philosophy of education was beginning to wane and was beginning to get exhausted, that's Christ came in the fullness of times. He came to perfect times. What many, many pagans became Christians because they saw Christ as a fulfillment. Justin Martyr, this is a little excursus here, Justin Martyr, the philosopher of the second century, taught philosophy, wore the philosopher's gown, found himself on the shore at Ephesus talking to an aged fisherman who witnessed to him. The end of the story is he's convinced by his witness and gives his life to Jesus Christ, the Logos. And Justin Martyr, as a new Christian and a philosopher, and a teacher of philosophy, does not take off his philosopher's gown because he says Christ is the absolute philosophy. Christ is the fulfillment of pagan longings. Christ is this new ideal become flesh, you see. So the church then looked at all that had come before it in Greece and Rome. You know, the Greeks conquered by the Romans appropriated their educational system to a good degree, not completely, but in large part. Certainly the liberal arts were taken up by the Romans. They liked Greeks to be their teachers, the aristocracy did, the Roman aristocracy. They'd hire Greek slaves to be their professor teachers right in their own households, and to be pedagogues, the ones who would walk ahead of the students and make sure they were doing their studies and carry their books and things like that. We get pedagogy from that word. You know that, because you're a teacher. Because you are a pedagogue, but you don't carry the books for your students, do you? What's the matter with you? Okay, that's an etymological issue. So the church takes a look at everything that happened, and they begin to sift and filter. And you know what the church decides about the seven liberal arts, the trivium arts certainly? That they're human arts, rooted in creation. And just as we can plunder the Egyptians, Augustine says, when the Israelites leave Egypt, you know that story, we can take the good even from unbelievers. The church appropriates it, and the church extends, owns it, adopts it, invests it, puts over all of it the queen, the governess theology, and extends it. And it begins to grow and multiply, and that's why you have this tradition. If not for the church, the liberal arts, I'm sure, would have died out. But the church said, these are human arts, and we will recapture it. We will reappropriate it and redeploy it in a new way. And with theology as a queen, there is now what the Greeks and Romans never had: coherence, unity, and telos, a purpose that really was a purpose, that was the concrete universal that the Greeks could never find. Because we have the ideal in Jesus Christ. We are to be conformed into His image, and everything that we do as believers in the ecclesia is to be conformed to Jesus and to follow Him. And if these liberal arts help us to do that, well, then we will use them as tools, but in subjection and in submission to Jesus Christ, the Logos. Isn't that exciting? I mean, that's a story that someone should make a movie out of, Grant. That should be... I know he likes film. As long as he's sitting up front, I'm going to continue to use him as an object illustration. He wrote a book called Meaning at the Movies, and you should read it. It's a very good book about film. At any rate, isn't this a captivating story? Do you see, though, at the root is community? So, if you have not community, it doesn't really matter, in my view, what else you do. It's so profoundly important about what it means to be a human being who's been created in God's image and redeemed by His Son, that if you don't have community, you're not going to have a school. And what happens in these renewal movements where we get excited about the seven liberal arts, and we should be, because it's an inheritance that we haven't received with great coherence. All of you have received, to some degree, this traditional education. If you've been through college, our colleges still, to some degree, reflect this tradition. The whole idea of a well-rounded liberal arts education is a remnant of that. Now, what we're doing is recovering it, renewing it with greater integrity and understanding and coherence. That's all. And we're not just going back in time. We're not nostalgic. It's not like we have this propensity to want to wear gowns like Justin Martyr did. It's not that we want to go back to the old wax horn books like the colonial Americans did. We're happy to use our MacBook Pros, aren't we? Be happy to do that. Happy to use new technology. Please get a Mac. Please get a Mac. It really will save you time. It's worth the investment. We are happy to use a lot of new things that come our way because we are shape-shifting. It's like there's DNA that will find new incarnations and new embodiments. It's like the bread, a culture, a bread culture. You know, friendship bread, you can pass around the culture. You want to add cinnamon to your loaf of bread, Andrew? That'd be fine, because he bakes. You want to add raisins, currants? You can do that, but the culture is still there. So you need, classical education's always been contextualized in new places, new geographies, in new cultures, new languages. Where's the Cambridge School folks? Raise your hands so everyone can see you. What modern language are you doing at Cambridge? Pardon me?
Mandarin.
They do Latin and Mandarin at Cambridge. They are contextualizing classical education in their particular area. They have a multicultural student body and staff, and they're representing it in their context. That's fine. There's a school called Trinity Christian Academy in Oahu, Hawaii. They study Latin and Japanese, because 40% of the people in Hawaii are of Japanese ancestry. Guess what? When classical education began to move throughout Europe, these kinds of things, it did change. It's not one thing. It's not one statue. It's a collection of ideas and arts that are always relevant to the shaping of a human soul. That was my introduction. Because Liz has given me 90 minutes to just blather on and on, I can do these long introductions that normally are a whole talk. Now, let's go to the slideshow. Good. And my colleague Matt is there making sure that the slides move along. So what I want to do with you in my time with you here the next couple of days, is give you the big picture. I kind of did this by my introductory comments. I try to give you the big picture and highlight the fact that community has a primary role. Education is a complex thing, isn't it? As an educator, if you're in an elevator and someone said, "Yo, you're an educator, what is your view of education? What's your approach to education? How would you define educational enterprise?" It's already complex. Right? It involves curriculum, involves facilities, involves budgeting, involves outcomes, it involves parent issues, involves funding. It's already multidimensional. And then, let's say you want to add liberal arts to that, as an adjective to education, liberal arts education or classical education. Well, classical, we're talking 2,500 years. How are you going to summarize what classical is in your elevator speech? Oh, it means the Greeks and the Romans, appropriated by the church, filtered. So, how are you going to do that on the elevator? There are books and books written about what classical can mean. It's a word with a wide semantic range and all kinds of connotations. And guess what? It's earned the right to have all those connotations. So we have classical music. We have classic rock. We have classic Coke. We have classy. We have classification. From the word classis, which originally meant a fleet of ships, ordering and ranking of a fleet of ships, we have class galore. And classical, what does classical mean? Well, it means a lot of things. So how do people know how you're using the word? I don't know. So we say classical education. And then let's say it's classical Christian education. You're in the elevator and someone says, "Oh, you're a Christian educator." Well, what's the difference between being an educator and a Christian educator? The elevator's going up. What are you going to say? If I said, "I want you to come visit my church," you say, "Well, I'm looking for a church. I just moved to the area. I might be interested in coming." "Well, tell me about your church." "Well, it's a Christian church." "Come to my Christian church." Is that enough to go on? "Well, it's a religious church, religious Christian church, worshipful." That helping you? We're traditional. "Oh, and we're evangelical." That solves it. Now I know exactly what your church is like. So we say classical Christian education, we're multiplying wide semantic ranges. So if you're sitting here and you're thinking, "I just got hired, I'm going to be a classical Christian educator. Liz, tell me what I'm supposed to do." And she's saying, "Well, become acquainted with 2,500 years of history by next week. And by the way, read the Old and New Testament, paying special attention to the word ecclesia and paideia." Okay. So when we get into something big, it's like coming into a cathedral, a big cathedral, like the Cathedral of Notre Dame. How are you going to understand that cathedral? Or going into the British Museum in London. How many of you have been to the British Museum in London? How long did you spend in the British Museum?
Days.
One day, okay. I thought you said days. Then I was going to commend you, because you could spend months, right, years. It's huge. Room leads onto room, and case and case. And at the British Museum, unlike America, where we talk about everything that you can see, all the art, but then we never let you get close to it. We just kind of talk about it, but you can never encounter it without mediation. At the British Museum, you go up the stairs, and there's the discus thrower. You know that famous sculpture of the discus thrower? Kind of looks a little bit like me. Maybe head like that. I was going to say, if I took off my shirt, you'd be convinced that it really was me. That's not true. That would just make you all leave. But the head's not quite on right, because it fell off at one point and they had to reconfigure it, glue it on. Apparently they did it wrong. But it's not the Greek sculpture. It's one of the four Roman copies that exist of the Greek sculpture. That's how much the Romans love the Greeks. They copied their sculptures they were trying to imitate the masters. That's a part of our tradition. Imitating excellence. Imitating masters. The way you teach rhetoric is theory, imitation, and practice. It's the way you do a lot. That's part of the liberal arts or classical tradition. Theory, what is it? Study it, look at it. Then you imitate, and then you practice. Just those three concepts are very, very helpful. You can be great. By the way, you're a new classical teacher? Come up to Liz and say, "Theory, imitation, and practice." And she'll think, you know, you're on your way. But at the British Museum, you can come right up to these things. There's no rope keeping you from the discosaur. In fact, I touched him. I wasn't supposed to. They have signs saying, please don't touch, but I looked around a little bit and I just touched him. Because I wanted to be in touch with the primary. Don't you want that yourself? Don't you long for that, your students? Students graduate from high school have never read the U.S. Constitution. So, we are going back and learning from the masters. I want to give you the big picture, but, oh, to finish my excursus, it's so big that you have to keep coming back and back. You know, you can't spend 1 hour at the British Museum. The first thing you encounter is the, what's the first thing you see coming into the British Museum, those of you who've been there? Shout it out. Big rock, big black rock. Three languages on it. The Rosetta Stone. There it is. Can you imagine? The Rosetta Stone broke the code of hieroglyphics. And there it is. It's the first thing you see. Now, they do have a case around that. I would love to touch the Rosetta Stone, but could not touch the Rosetta Stone. You have to keep going. You go to a cathedral. There's a new room. There's something else to see. So take your time. An inheritance that is this big is something that you need to be discipled into. And that you it's like... It's like building a house. It's like getting in shape. It's like adopting a healthy lifestyle. You do it over time. So be patient with yourselves. Americans are impatient. We want everything instantly. We want the quick answers. That's not going to happen. Still, you need a map. And what I want to give you now is a map. But instead of the metaphor of a map, I'm going to use the metaphor of a box top. The box top to a puzzle. If you're working on a puzzle, say it's got 500 pieces, wouldn't it be more challenging to just throw away the box top? Wouldn't that be great? Have you ever had to build a puzzle without a box top? It's a pretty frustrating experience. So we need to see the whole. We need to have a picture of everything to kind of know where we are, to get our orientation. And then from there, we can start looking at the pieces. So next slide, please, Matt. In our culture, there is a view of education that's somewhat fragmented. The pieces, that which has been handed down to us, has not been handed down to us with coherence. And so we're trying to figure our way. And many of you feel this sense of displacement and uncertainty. And you're trying to put things together because you're a human being. You want to classify. You want things to have coherence. And you're not quite sure how it all works together. How about the modern and the classical? How do they work together? How about technology and the liberal arts tradition? What are the seven liberal arts, and how does a quadrivium, you know, geometry, music, astronomy, arithmetic, how do they relate to calculus and physics? Do we really do astronomy? You know, these questions are, and many others are going to come to mind. Now there are answers to those questions, but you can't answer them all at once, can you? So we're trying to find the pieces, trying to put them together. And if we could see, and next slide, please, Matt. If we could see the whole thing, maybe we would, some of our anxiety would begin to melt away because at least we'd see our direction, at least we'd see the box top. And if you look at this slide, you'll see that there are 12 pieces. And this is not the only way to organize this vast tradition, but because it's so vast, I think we need organizational schemes to try to help us. Just like you need a place to put your hat, you need a peg. So I'm going to offer you some 4 pegs and then 12 pegs. Again, I want to emphasize, this is not the only way to do it. Others have done other things, but here's what I'm going to offer for you. So, next slide please, Matt. Every educational system has to ask the question, who, what, where, and why? Who is the student? This is our anthropology. What is a human being? And we also, then once we've answered that question, who is a human being? Of course, as Christians, we have some specific ideas about this that modern, skeptical, agnostic, materialist types don't share. And that's one reason why they're not in community with us to some degree. And then once we know who a student is, we're asking, well, what are we going to do with the student? What curriculum are we going to take them through? Curriculum means a circle, a course. What course are we going to have them run? And then we have to ask ourselves, if we're going to do that, where are we going to do it? You can do this in home. You can do it with homeschooling and tutoring. But in a school setting, we have to ask ourselves, what is the school? What is it going to be like? How is it going to teach this curriculum? And then finally, we have to answer the question, as any educator does, what's it all about? What's the purpose? What are we after? The why. And you'll see as you go across those columns that there are three areas that I've highlighted for each one. In the classical tradition, we focus on the student as a soul and a body. So it's soul-focused, it's embodied, and we focus on also what a student should be, and that is at leisure. That means able to reflect, think, digest, ingest, actually study, think, reflect, and grow. And now we're going to move to our concert, where we're going to celebrate this particular aspect of the classical tradition. Jeff Culp is going to be singing the solo. Okay? The rest of the band would come upstage. We'll get going right away. Oh, actually, that's later. I'm sorry. They're just getting set up. Thank you. I know they were doing a good deed. And then we have the curriculum, Seven Liberal Arts. Can you read this? I'm going to show it to you a little bit more clearly in a moment. By the way, pause. Some of you are going to be thinking, I have to write all this down. How about instead, I just email you this whole presentation? Okay, here's my email address. I can't put it up on the screen because I don't, Matt, we have it already kind of fixed. But it's cperrin at classicalsubjects with an s at the end .com. I'll flash that on my next talk. I do have an image, that the text for that. And maybe, Liz, we can work this out. And you, those of you who are administrators from the other schools, I could email them to you, perhaps, and you could distribute them. But don't feel like you have to write down everything here if you're feeling frustrated about that, because there's going to be a good bit of information at certain points. So the curriculum, Seven Liberal Arts, of course, that's, we talked about that. Pedagogy, how do we teach it? The great ideas, the great conversation. That are three ways that we could, three elements of the curriculum in the classical tradition. So think of four cores to any education: who, what, where, why. The student, the curriculum, the school, and reaching the world. What are we going to do in the world? And then three elements under each of those cores. One organizational scheme that might help you. 12 elements altogether, therefore, that might help you to think about the tradition that we're in and trying to recover with coherence and integrity. Under school, we will talk about community and its ecclesial dimension and its traditional dimension as well. And under the why question or purpose, we'll talk about a personal purpose, a liberated mind that's been set free by a study of the liberal arts, equipped to do lots of great things, and we'll talk about how this education is renewable and renewing, seeking to renew or make culture. Now, next slide, please. The next slide shows that our modern era also has answers to these questions of the who, the where, the what, and the why. So our modern educational system has, next slide, Matt, has a view of the student and the curriculum and the community and so forth. It, under student, tends to be child-centered, emphasizes entertainment and amusement, doing so many things that students tend to be filled with activity but also with anxiety rather than reflection and discussion and so forth. Under curriculum, it tends to be utilitarian and functionary. We want to prepare people for work, for jobs, very pragmatically oriented. The curriculum tends to be quantified and testable, has to be scientific, has to be measurable on almost every step along the way. Grading, by the way, is a recent invention. 150 years, say. So if you go back to 1600, 1700, 1500, and so forth, there was not a numerical grading system the way we have it. There was assessment and evaluation, to be sure, but not using this kind of factory methodology that we use. I would argue that this is one way that modern education is still with us, even in classical traditional schools. I'm going to argue that there's a blend, that we should not be thinking of complete polarities here. That every classical Christian school that I know of has aspects of the modern in it. And every modern school that I know has aspects of the traditional liberal arts in it. So it's really, think of a spectrum. Where are you going to be on the spectrum or this continuum? That is really a better way of thinking about it. Rather than classifying people as being classical, non-classical, traditional, secular, progressive, and so forth. We need to go deeper than that to really understand what's happening. They have a view of the school. Popular youth culture tends to reign. Of course, it's secular rather than ecclesial, and it tends to be experimental rather than focusing on the traditional. 5-year cycles of new approaches to education, for example, is a regular outcome from the teaching universities and the teaching faculties at our universities and colleges. And in terms of the purpose, the ultimate purpose is work and acquiring credentials and acquiring popular success, which generally means comfort and financial freedom. Those are the things that are lifted up as the high things. This is a generalization, to be sure. So we have two paradigms, two box tops that are in tension with one another. But they're not complete polarities. In fact, next slide. Could you go back up one? Okay. I didn't put the, on my next talk you'll see the slide. I created a slide with both of them merged together. Okay, to show that there are elements where they do merge and overlap. Okay, so that should give everybody, everyone can take a deep breath right now. You are somewhat classical. You are somewhat progressive and modern. By the way, classical does not necessarily mean good, and progressive does not necessarily always mean evil. That would be a facile analysis. We have to be a little more subtle. Because what do we mean by progressive being evil? For example, standardized tests. That's a result of progressive education. That came about in the 1930s. A guy named Thorndike and others developed mental testing, first for the Army, then it was applied to education. The advent of educational psychology, studying the way, in a scientific environment, how human beings learn, developmental psychology and so forth. All of these things began to grow in the early part of the century and have become quite present in our educational system, even in our classical Christian schools. Do you do standardized testing? Is that helpful? SAT tests? Does that have a place? Okay. Well, that's one of the fruits of the progressive approach. So we ought to be careful not to just whitewash, or I should say, kind of generalize and disparage everything that's progressive and everything that's modern. And we should also be asking as Christians, when our tradition comes to us, we don't unquestioningly adopt our tradition. We are always assessing and critical of our own tradition, because we're Semper Reformanda. We believe that our elders have got a lot of things right, and we're going to respect them, we're going to learn from them, we're going to appropriate a lot of what they did, but maybe not everything. Maybe not their discipline system. Other things too. Do you know, for example, that the classical system generally educated the children in separate gender, by separate gender, by female and female? We don't do that as much, and there's some practical reasons why we don't. But I don't really know of any classical Christian schools that are thriving that are all girl or all guy school. So we're critical of our own tradition too. So we need to adopt a more thoughtful assessment, and when we talk about these things, and I think the box top metaphor can help us to do that, to help us to see that we're really on a continuum here. That these folks from Maranatha and so forth, you could go back and say, you know what, we really enjoyed this, that, and the other, and we're going to appropriate some things, but we're not going to go that far on the spectrum in terms of being classical. And that's what you should be doing. Assessing, thinking, asking. Okay, so we could take these two approaches and put them, next slide please, Matt. We could put them in two columns. I know you can't read that, so I'm going to give you a version that's a little easier to read. But the classical approach and the modern approach, and you could ask yourself by going down these two columns, where do I tend to land? And we have I have a version of this that has numbers across it, so you can kind of actually color in dots along the way. It could be an interesting assessment. You could go through these two columns and see where you lean. Maybe at some point you'd be right in the middle. Maybe you lean more to the left, meaning more towards the classical tradition. In some areas, you might lean more to the modern tradition. For example, next slide, please. Under student, do you tend to focus on the student as a living soul? Do you tend to think of a student as a soul who is to be shaped and nourished? That comes from Plato, appropriated by the church. That education is about the nourishment, the development, and the shaping of a soul. Not teaching a man to make a living, but teaching a man how to live. Do you think of your students as souls? Lewis said, you don't have a body. No, excuse me. He said, you don't have a soul. Now, what did he say? No, he said, you don't have a soul. You are a soul. You have a body. Well, really, it's both. Dare I correct Lewis? We are both. We are embodied spirits. Or we are if we're bodied spirits, we're spirited bodies. Either way, it works the same way. So we have a soul, we also have a body. Are you trying to nourish a soul? Do you think that the five senses have a significant role in the way you educate? What do your rooms look like? I'm going to give a talk on it. One of my latter talks tomorrow is going to be on this subject, embodying education. Students are shaped more than they are taught at a whiteboard. What you do in front of the whiteboard with your positive presentations is probably the least effective thing you do, all things considered, as an educator. The most important thing you do is love your students as a soul. And you seek to speak to them and shape them by what they see, what they hear, what they feel, what they taste. And you don't think of Christianity simply as a set of ideas that you download into their brains. As if we just get them to believe the right ideas and they'll go out and be great Christians. That won't work. It doesn't work. That's why some 70% of our students graduating from Christian schools and Christian youth groups, according to Christian Smith in Souls in Transition and books about what's going on with the youth culture, they are leaving the church. You know this if you follow your graduates. Cokes and jokes and youth groups are not making it. They need an embodied education. It needs to be their community, and we'll speak about this in a moment. Paideia needs to seep into every pore, wherever they turn. They're tasting it. It's like they're in a cathedral. And then, so where do you, or entertainment and amusement, where do you land? Do you tend to focus on keeping your kids happy, fulfilling their desires and wishes, whatever they are? What the wishes that have been stirred up as they've been on the internet and watching movies and television and involved in other aspects of the mall and the youth culture, they bring in certain desires, passions that have been kindled. Do you speak to those passions, or do you seek to reorient those passions and craft and create and train their affections so that they will love that which is lovely? If before I quoted Plato, I've just quoted Augustine, education. He talks about the ordo amoris, the ordering of our love. We are to order and train the affections and passions of students into the Christian ideal of human flourishing. And we should be able to hold forth that ideal as a grand celebration that is more attractive and alluring than the mall and Facebook and the latest movie. That means we should spend as much time doing culture making in our schools as we do curriculum development. That means it's really important when Liz stands up and says, welcome, tell me your name, stand up, where are you from? That stuff is all of a piece. It's creating a context and a culture that kids get. It's just civility and courtesy and manners and love. It's the fundamental thing that applies as time goes by. If we don't love one another, we have nothing. We're a clanging gong. We are to love one another, each other deeply from the heart. And we can get so caught up in implementing a curriculum that we stop loving each other. We stop keeping short accounts within our relationships. We engage in gossip and criticism and rumblings and all, you know, that where the sins of the tongue are rampant, and we tolerate it because we are building a great curriculum or a great sports program or building a new facility. And meanwhile, our kids see us not loving each other, not loving them. We have to repent. And, you know, Jonathan Edwards said about the first American Great Awakening that when the devil can't stop something good from happening that God's doing, he gets behind and he pushes. He pushes it to excess. And we can get so excited about what we're doing in other areas that we stop loving one another. The greatest sin in this renewal movement of classical Christian education is, someone tell me what it is. What is our greatest sin? Say it louder.
Pride.
Pride. You know, we're giving our lives for this stuff, and we're not making a lot of money doing it. And, you know, it better be worthwhile. And what a good boy am I that I am doing this. I'm a sacrificial educator, renewing this great tradition. It's been neglected by the world, but I am restoring it. And look at what our kids are doing. They're a lot smarter than those other kids at the public school. Look at our standardized test scores. And, of course, I'm exaggerating it, but we do boast and parade in our own ways. We want it to make ourselves feel worthy of the sacrifice we've made. And it is deadening. And James says God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. If you adopt pride, if pride slips into your school, no matter how great your curriculum and your pedagogy, God will oppose you. And you will not be of kingdom use. He will find someone else. Part of the classical tradition is community and love, which involves humility. Men and women, the theological virtues of faith, hope, and love must be primary in our schools. Faith, hope, and love, before we get to the intellectual virtues that we're seeking to impart to our students. The intellectual virtues will be my last talk. Do you love one another? What? How would you rank yourself here in terms of the curriculum? Do you tend to be liberal arts focused, or are you more utilitarian focused? Are you thinking mainly of getting the kids in to the next spot, getting them into the right college, getting them the right job, helping them to be effective in our society, or do you focus on great ideas? Do you focus on the contemporary ideas, the new, the novel? Are you focusing a lot on what's testable and measurable, making your teachers do a lot of assessments and justifying those assessments in minute detail to the cranky parents who have to review the grades? Or do you focus instead on a pedagogy that is a pedagogy of desire and love and training the affections and pursuing that which is the good, the true, and the beautiful in sustained conversation and exploration and investigation, diving deep? Matt, thanks for following me, because I haven't even telling you to do the slides. This guy is intuitive. Next one, where? The school. How do you see yourself here? Are you communal? How are the staff relations at your school? Do you have collegiality? When Christ came, he didn't just unite the arts. He brought coherence to the seven liberal arts. Theology is the governance, but he united hearts. Are you united? Do you back each other up? What happens when a parent comes and offers a criticism of your colleague? I'm so glad that John is now in fifth grade with you, Lisa. Fourth grade wasn't so well with Jennifer. You know what I mean? What do you do when you get a comment like that? Do you refrain from gossip? And you will gossip. Do you say, I'm sorry, when you do? The greatest threat, in my experience, to the collegiality of a staff team is the sins of the tongue. Sins of the tongue. And we have to model for our students what we have for them. And we will sin with our tongues. Can we repent and show our students that we are repenting? We will complain. We will fuss. We will criticize from time to time. How about the church? Is the church connected to your school in a vibrant way? The classical tradition says that the church is very important. I bet you have many, many churches represented in your school. It's often said that the schools can only rise as high as the churches around them. We have to support our churches. I'll talk more about this in my talk about embodied learning, but the church needs to be present. Traditional. We've talked about that. Lastly, moving a little more quickly here, what about purpose? How do you see your school's purpose? Is there a view of vocation? Do your students understand where they're going and why? Or is there purpose that to be a nurtured soul, or is it to be a functionary, a worker? Is their mind liberated? Are they equipped? Have you taught them that what you want to do is equip them to learn how to learn and to go anywhere that they would choose to go and master a subject, master an area, master a vocation, a profession, and go forward? Are you renewing them? Are they thinking of renewing the culture and making culture themselves? Virtuous shapers of culture. Transformation. Or do you tend to, even if that's on your mission statement, do you tend to essentially focus on work, giving them credentials, and the consumer culture? Community, paideia. Let me just take a pause here and see where we are with time and make sure that we can have some discussion. What's our time right now? 9:40? We started at 8:30, so we have about 20 minutes. Okay. I want you to stand up for a second. Just stretch if you want. I'm going to just take about a 30-second break here. If you want to go get some coffee, get something to drink, why don't we make it actually a two-minute break? So go ahead and take a break, stretch, and we're going to come back for some discussion. If you wanted me to go a little bit longer, but I'll let you be. What we're going to do now is talk about practical ways we do this in the school.
Great.
And so I have a number of suggestions, and then I'd like people to share what they do to build community.
Great. Good.
And if you think the conversation is going really well and you want it to go a little longer, fine, but I'll pay attention to you.
Okay. Great. Awesome. Thank you.
You're welcome. All right, one more minute. Get your coffee.
Dr. Phillips.
Great talk so far.
Joining us this year,
oh, really?
As our Red Oak School Science Chair.